numbers of the Cornhill Magazine, 1878. It qualified itself in that publication and afterwards as a study, for reasons which I confess I fail to recapture, unless they may have taken account simply of a certain flatness in my poor little heroine's literal denomination. Flatness, indeed, one must have felt, was the very sum of her story, so that perhaps, after all, the attached epithet was meant but as a deprecation, addressed to the reader, of any great critical hope of stirring scenes. It provided for mere concentration, and on an object scant and superficially vulgar, from which, however, a sufficiently brooding tenderness might eventually extract a shy, incongruous charm. I suppress, at all events here, the appended qualification, in view of the simple truth, which ought from the first to have been apparent to me, that my little exhibition is made to no degree whatever in critical, but quite inordinately and extravagantly in poetical terms. It comes back to me that I was at a certain hour long afterwards to have reflected, in this connection, on the characteristic free play of the whirligig of time. It was in Italy again, in Venice, and in the prized society of an interesting friend, now dead, with whom I happened to wait on the Grand Canal at the animated water steps of one of the hotels. The considerable little terrace there was so disposed as to make a salient stage for certain demonstrations on the part of two young girls, children, they, if ever, of nature and of freedom, whose use of those resources in the general public eye, and under our own, as we sat in the gondola, drew from the lips of a second companion, sociably afloat with us, the remark that there before us, with no sign absent, were a couple of attesting Daisy Millers. Then it was that, in my charming hostess's prompt protest, the whirligig, as I have called it, at once betrayed itself. How can you liken those creatures to a figure of which the only fault is touchingly to have transmuted so sorry a type, and to have, by a poetic artifice, not only led our judgment of it astray, but made any judgment quite impossible? With which this gentle lady and admirable critic turned on the author himself. You know you quite falsified, by the turn you gave it, the thing you had begun with having in mind, the thing you had had to satiety the chance of observing. Your pretty perversion of it, or your unprincipled mystification of our sense of it, does it really too much honor. In spite of which, nonetheless, as anything charming or touching always to that extent justifies itself, we after a fashion forgive and understand you. But why waste your romance? There are cases too many in which you've done it again, in which, provoked by a spirit of observation at first no doubt sufficiently sincere, and with the measured and felt truth fairly twitching your sleeve, you have yielded to your incurable prejudice in favor of grace, to whatever it is in you that makes so inordinately for form and prettiness and pathos, not to say sometimes for misplaced drolling. Is it that you've after all too much imagination? Those awful young women capering at the hotel door, they are the real little Daisy Millers that were, whereas yours, in the tale, is such a one, more's the pity, as, for pitch of the ingenuousness, for quality of the artless, couldn't possibly have been at all. My answer to all which bristled, of course, with more professions than I can or need report here, the chief of them inevitably to the effect that my supposedly typical little figure was, of course, pure poetry, and had never been anything else, since this is what helpful imagination, in however slight a dose, ever directly makes for. As for the original grossness of readers, I dare say I added, that was another matter, but one which, at any rate, had then quite ceased to signify. Daisy Miller by Henry James. Chapter 1. At the little town of Vevey, in Switzerland, there is a particularly comfortable hotel.